When the Huffington Post picked 13 bankers by James Kwok and today's guest Simon Johnson, Book of the Month for April, they pointed to some impressive numbers. From 1974 to 2006, the average amount of money it took to get elected to the House went from $56,000 to $1,250,000. And the financial sector was the top contributor to political campaigns over the last two decades. According to 13 bankers, from 1998 to 2008, quote, the financial sector spent $1.7 billion on campaign contributions and $3.4 billion on lobbying. And they targeted their gifts to representatives in positions of power over financial legislation, regardless of party. A year ago, after these banks caused the crisis that still wreaks enormous suffering on individuals and families here and abroad, Dick Durbin said of the banking lobby, they frankly own the place. Now, as Congress debates financial reform, the money has only increased. And the authors point out, it's not just the money. Quote, the constant flow of people from Wall Street to Washington and back ensured that important decisions were made by officials who had absorbed the financial sector's view of the world and its perspective on government policy, and who often saw their future careers on Wall Street, not Washington. Quote again, politics is like sales, write Johnson and Kwok. If you are trying to close a large deal with a major corporation, it helps to have friends on the inside. It helps to have buyers who see their fortunes aligned with yours. And it can even help to dangle the prospect of a high-paying job before the key decision-maker. Remember, Rahm Emanuel's the one who said, rule one, never allow a crisis to go to waste. There are opportunities to do big things. But it's actually the very people who created the crisis that have taken advantage of it and done big things. Again, I'm quoting Simon and Kwok. In the United States, we like to think that oligarchies are a problem that other countries have, but the fact that our American oligarchy operates not by bribery or blackmail, but by the soft power of access and ideology makes it no less powerful. We have the most advanced political system in the world, but we also have its most advanced oligarchy. Simon Johnson, former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, is currently professor of entrepreneurship at MIT's Sloan School of Management and a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington. He's the co-author of Starting Over in Eastern Europe and co-founder of the blog site The Baseline Scenario with James Kwok, with whom he also co-authored the book 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover and the Next Financial Meltdown. Welcome, Simon Johnson.
Nice to be with you.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas. So you're a professor of entrepreneurship at MIT's School of Business, and you were chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. How do those two roles fit together?
Well, what I really am, Terence, is someone who's worked long and hard on crises, economic crises of all kinds around the world. And one of the things we found early on, I've been doing this for more than 20 years, is that the key to recovery in many situations was entrepreneurs. It was new people doing new things. And a lot of times countries got themselves into trouble because an old structure, right, like Chaebols in Korea or some very powerful families in Thailand or some oil barons in Russia, that they had just taken over. They got way too much power. They managed themselves and the country into disaster. And as part of the recovery, there was a bunch of macroeconomic things. That's the chief economist of the IMF type of issues. But there's also a bunch of micro people level things, which are about, you know, letting new people come forward with new ideas and don't let them get ripped off by the old structures anymore.
Okay. And now, how does your experience at the IMF inform your views, as I heard just in what you were saying, of this financial crisis and how to deal with it?
Frankly, I think it's the same pattern as we've seen elsewhere. Now, obviously, the United States is different. We're richer. We have a better education level on average. We have some great technology. We have a very innovative core to this economy. We also have some deeply troubled, problematic financial structures. And specifically, I'm talking about the big banks, the 13 bankers who were saved by the Obama administration in March, April of last year, the most generous financial bailout in the history of humankind, I would argue. That's just extraordinary and actually mind-boggling. And the big banks that remain today actually were down to a big six that have become bigger as a result of the crisis, if you can believe that.
Oh, yeah.
And their attitude, as, for example, represented by Jamie Dimon, who's the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, one of the biggest banks, is, hey, if we're big, it's because we're good and we should be allowed to get bigger. And he says that's the market. This is not a market, Terence. This is capture of the state by some powerful interests. It is not something that is helpful to regular people, to ordinary businesses. People across the political spectrum get this. And it must stop.
Very good. Let me just go back a little bit more into your background, since we have an hour here. We are going to focus on those stuff and the 13 bankers. But you founded the Baseline Scenario blog site. And what is the Baseline Scenario? What will people find there? It's baselinescenario.com, correct?
Right.
One word, baselinescenario.com. What's there? And so, why did you found it?
When I was at the IMF, my job was to work out with my colleagues and with other governments through a sort of an interesting process of interaction, and then to present to the world, where's the world economy going and why? And, you know, we call that the baseline scenario at the IMF. And around the baseline scenario, you talk about various kinds of risks, upside and downside risks in the jargon. So when I left the IMF, I thought it would be interesting and a good idea to present to people a baseline scenario, which is not the IMF's, it's our own, but it's the same idea. Where is the global economy going and why? And as stuff happens, as news develops, you have to revise your scenario up or down or change your assessment of the balance of risks. Now, we were going to do this over some, you know, moderately long period of time, but then I left the IMF in August 2008. The financial crisis broke in earnest massively in September 2008. So we decided to go right ahead and we started baseline scenario at that moment. Think of it as what the IMF would tell you or should tell you if it could speak truth to authority in the United States, which it can't actually.
Very good. And finally, just one question about your working process. You founded Baseline Scenario, the blog site, and you co-wrote this book with James Kwok. I know who you are. He, I looked at, has been more an entrepreneur himself, and so how do you work together?
He's actually also my brother-in-law. He's my wife's brother. We've known each other for a long time. He has a PhD in history from Berkeley. He went to work for McKinsey. He then went into the tech sector and set up his own software company. He's a Silicon Valley entrepreneur. The company's been successful. He has, in a sense, retired. He's a young guy still.
And
in his relative retirement, he decided to go to Yale Law School and become a public interest lawyer. Yes, I'm just a boring economist. He's a multi-talented guy. And he knows, what's I think really good about the partnership, is James knows an enormous amount about economics. But he's not an economist. So I think I write quite well for an economist, but that is not saying very much.
Exactly.
James writes well and explains things well. And I think the website, if it's been successful, well, it has been successful. Because it's been successful because we are relatively clear in our explanation. We run a pretty good discussion there. The commentators, for the most part, are terrific. And people can learn a lot from reading that stuff and interacting with us.
Well, I'm glad I asked that because that does sound like an interesting synthesis where before you at the IMF are talking mostly to people who speak your language and so on. Now you want to speak to everyone, and sifting everything through a non-economist makes sense to me. Over the last couple of months, I actually have scheduled it so I spend every other week on politics and the economic crisis, and then I go and deal with the rest of our lives in the other weeks. I've interviewed Joseph Stiglitz, William Grider, Michael Lewis. What I noticed when I was preparing for this, Simon, was we've dealt a lot with the causes of the 08 meltdown. What we haven't dealt with much is the historical context, especially before the deregulation of the 80s and 90s. In other words, what has it been like in the U.S. from its founding? I haven't found enough time to deal with the potential solutions and what's going on in legislation. So I'd like us to make that the meat of what we do here. So in 13 Bankers, your first chapter is titled Thomas Jefferson and the Financial Aristocracy. Can you take us through briefly the U.S. history of finance's relationship with government?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually think this is very important, Terrence, because what we're facing today is not a one-off. It's part of a repeated cycle in American history, which begins with Jefferson. Jefferson, if you remember, had a big debate with Alexander Hamilton about the nature of the U.S. from an economic point of view, and then both of them realized that the economic structure was going to have a big impact on social structure and on political structure going forward. Now, I have to say, in that discussion, for the most part, Hamilton won, and Hamilton was actually right on a lot of things about what would make for a dynamic entrepreneurial economy. But Jefferson had a point, a very important point, which is if you let bankers get too big and too powerful, they will capture the state, they will take things over and distort them. And I think that's exactly what we've seen repeatedly. In the 1830s, Andrew Jackson faced down the Second Bank of the United States, run by a guy called Nicholas Biddle. There was a huge confrontation between an elected Democrat and the number one banker in the country. And against the odds, to be frank, Jackson won, and that's why his picture's on the $20 bill, by the way. And we had a good 19th century in part, I would argue, we do argue in the book, because the way in which Jackson won and what that...
And he won early in the century and then...
Well, he won just as the new industrial technologies were really coming on stream. And, you know, you can argue about what the alternative scenarios would have been for the U.S. in the 19th century, but we certainly didn't follow a Mexico-Brazil-type route, right, which could have been possible, I think, even at that point, where you had a relatively strong oligarchy, new people couldn't come in to the same degree. And those societies also based largely on immigrants. Argentina would be another case,
sure,
right, where they never managed to take those industrial technologies and build a broad-based mass democratic society in the way that we did with all its imperfections in the United States. But, of course, by the end of the 19th century, things were all different. By the end of the 19th century, you had this process of consolidation and mergers, and people like J.P. Morgan were rising, and there was the rise of the industrial and railroad trusts. Theodore Roosevelt decided to take that on in 1902. Again, huge showdown, which he won, probably against the odds, to be frank. He didn't fix everything. He didn't fix the financial part of it, and we talk about why in the book. And this came back to haunt us in the 1920s. And it's actually FDR, who fixed that with the regulations and the rules came out.
Let me take you back for a second, because I know that this actually is important to where we go from here. When Roosevelt took on the trust, I've heard you say that this was new thinking. No one quite understood that you could even question them and challenge them, and yet he moved public opinion. He was able to do it. So, one, a little bit more about the context, but two, Simon Johnson, you said he handled part of it but not the financial part. So what did he leave hanging, which then his cousin took care of years later?
So there's a couple of points important here. First is that certainly within the mainstream in 1902, there was no view that monopoly was bad. Big was beautiful in America. Now, you can find some precursors. You can find some, you know, academic scribblers who had argued against monopoly, but that was not in the mainstream. There was the Sherman Antitrust Act on the books, but it had never been used successfully against industrial trusts. Okay. And the Supreme Court, the view was the Supreme Court would not uphold the use of Sherman antitrust against railroad monopolies, for example. And by the way, Theodore Roosevelt won his case 5-4 in the Supreme Court. Now, out of that came a lot of good things, but it was 5-4, all right?
As you say, that demonstrates that the country was not converted to his way of thinking. It was a tight contest.
Well, I don't think the Supreme Court necessarily reflects the mainstream consensus ever. But it is certainly true that in 1902, Roosevelt had a lot of explaining to do. By 1912, when Standard Oil was broken up, so this is after Roosevelt left office, you know, the idea of antitrust was pretty widespread. In fact, President Taft, who was not a very dynamic figure, President 1908, 1912, actually launched more antitrust cases than Roosevelt did because he had the momentum at that point, right?
Right. Now you've established
it was a mainstream, boring, sensible, responsible policy thing that even President Taft could do, right? So that's very important. That's a shift in the consensus. There was a weakness around that, and I wouldn't want to, you know, I would not want to exaggerate Teddy Roosevelt's ability to understand or deal with all the dimensions here, because the financial sector was not fully constrained as effectively as the industrial trust. We ended up with this rather strange compromise of the Federal Reserve, which was founded in 1913, as a hybrid public-private institution. And it's still a hybrid, by the way, and most people don't know this. In no other serious, big, substantial, rich country that I'm aware of is the central bank anything other than a government agency.
Uh-huh.
But in the United States, we still have the banks as, you know, having joint shared control over some aspects of the Fed, right? It's an interesting thing, and this fed into the boom of the 1920s, although I would also emphasize that the First World War, end of the First World War, when the U.S. entered, there were a lot of controls put on the U.S. economy. And there was distortions that resulted from those. Those were wartime controls. And after the war, there was a very big feeling that we should just, you know, go back to a freer age. And this gave us the 1920s, which, of course, were wonderful when we were in them.
A nice bubble to be part of.
Yes, that's right. And then it was a catastrophic collapse, which FDR had to deal with and clean up.
And so now I understand what you're saying is that Roosevelt dealt with trust, dealt with monopolies, but didn't deal fully with the financial sector.
Right.
Yeah.
And we start the book with an epigraph from The Great Gatsby.
I know
for exactly this reason.
Read it. I was going to bring it up.
And this is a link between the system and the individuals, right? They were careless people, Tom and Daisy. They smashed up things and creatures and then retreated back into their money or their vast carelessness or whatever it was that kept them together and let other people clean up the mess they had made. That's The Great Gatsby, right? That's the 20s. That's also today.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's interesting. I actually just read that book for the first time this year. And to see that what he writes is a very small story about, you know, three individuals, basically, and yet you know, you use it as the front of your book to say this is not just about three people. This is a bit about America. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Simon Johnson. We're talking about the new book he's written with James Kwok, 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover and the Next Financial Meltdown. And he and Kwok also have a very vibrant and active blog site, baselinescenario.com, where you can learn a lot more. From Roosevelt to deregulation, what happened besides the fact that we had a war and we had a good stretch? I mean, America from World War II to 1973, which is when real wages started falling and when oil started tightening up, we had a good run there. What was going on?
We had a great run. And it's very important, Terrence, to remember we started a lot of new companies, a lot of new ideas. It was a great time to be middle class or lower middle class and trying to work your way up in America.
We really had the social mobility we talk about at that point.
We had a lot of venture capital, too. We had the beginnings of Silicon Valley. We had new companies. We had new technology. It's very important because in that context of risk-taking and innovation entrepreneurship, the financial sector was relatively controlled. The banks did not get out of hand, all right? There is an idea that, for example, Goldman Sachs tries to impress on everyone today that we need Goldman Sachs in order to take risk in America. That's fundamentally at odds with the historical record. Banking in the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s was safe. It was relatively well paid. It was also boring. There's so-called 363 banking. You pay 3% on deposits, you lend it out at 6%, and you're on the golf course by 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So it wasn't a bad job, don't get me wrong. I don't think there were a lot of poor bankers out there, but they did not have the ability to take the kind of destabilizing risks that they developed once regulation took hold as we moved into the 80s and particularly into the 90s.
Deregulation.
Yeah.
And so what were the prime deregulations that happened, and what was the rationale at the time? Now, remember, what I'm saying here is, contextually, they were not as powerful. Nowadays, or prior to the, you know, nowadays true, that what we're saying is still true, but prior to the crash, they could dictate. Government did what they wanted. That wasn't so true. They weren't as powerful. So what was it that led, that fed this deregulation?
It's an interesting story, and that's I'd say the middle third of the book. Actually, there was a review this week from Business Week where they said they loved the beginning of the book and the end of the book, but they thought the middle of the book, while meticulously researched, was completely obvious and everybody knew this by now, which I thought was very encouraging. I was very pleased, Terrence, to learn that the things we've been arguing for really hard against a lot of opposition over the past couple of years are actually now mainstream. So I'm delighted to
job well done.
Declare victory. So. Because it is an interesting history, and it is not a conspiracy. It is not a deliberate, you know, three guys got together and said, hey, let's go build an incredibly dangerous system. It was a series of public policy moves, of course, influenced massively by the Reagan Revolution and that broad sort of deregulation.
That worldview.
Worldview, and you know, it's about Margaret Thatcher as well, and it's not just the United States, although the U.S. was the heart of it. And it's actually, you know, Reagan drew very deeply on the same kind of thinking from the 1920s, by the way. Talk about historical parallels. You can go back and look at a lot of things Herbert Hoover used to say and believe in, and then see that picked up by Ronald Reagan. It's a cycle.
What's interesting is the crisis took longer to happen.
Yes, and that's for a number of reasons, including the fact that in the 80s, the Democrats controlled Congress, and they generally resisted most of what Reagan wanted to do. The savings and loan would be an exception. The savings and loan did lead to a crisis in the deregulation and partial distortion of that market led to a crisis fairly immediately. But the real, you know, there was a lot of incremental change, which really picked up pace and became more complete when what I would call the Wall Street wing of the Democratic Party, led by Robert Rubin, prevailed within the Clinton administration.
So, in other words, just for folks, Reagan had a worldview. Reagan had a belief, but there was a counterbalance.
The Democrats were suspicious with good reason.
And once Clinton got into office, in fact, there was little counterbalance.
Well, the first 2 years, as you know, of the Clinton administration, there were strong forces within the Clinton administration, Robert Reich pushing more towards a controlled structure and being much more profoundly suspicious of the financial sector, and a Robert Rubin pushing the other way. And Rubin, of course, became Secretary of the Treasury. After basically 2 years, the Clinton administration changed course. And from that point on, it became very pro-market and very much a deregulating force of deregulation. And this, of course, lined up with Alan Greenspan, who, you know, is the ultimate representation of Ronald Reagan and even more extreme free market ideas.
Ayn Rand.
Absolutely. And so Greenspan plus Rubin, Arthur Levitt actually freely concedes he was on board now.
Levitt at SEC?
Absolutely. Larry Summers, who was Deputy Treasury Secretary, very influential on the intellectual side, who in the 1980s, fascinatingly enough, as an academic, had written some of the early papers that were skeptical of the free market view. In the 1990s, when he's working with Mr. Rubin, he goes exactly the opposite way. And of course, there was one person, and precisely one person, who opposed this. Her name was Brooksley Bourne.
Yes.
She was the head of the CFTC, which is the regulator that watches over regulated derivatives, and there are some. And she wanted to extend the remit, the scope of her committee, to take in all these over-the-counter derivatives. And in an interesting and curious, completely coincidental echo of the 13 bankers who finally got the bailout, in March 2009 from the Obama administration, in early 1998, when Brooksley Bourne was trying to rein in over-the-counter derivatives. And you know, she was far ahead of her time. The levels of risk that we've seen subsequently were nothing. You know, what she saw then was nothing compared to what came later.
The amount of leverage and the amount
of risk. Absolutely.
She sniffed it early.
Exactly. And Larry Summers called her up And this is in the this has been reported in the press, and this is not contested by the protagonist in the story. Larry Summers called her up and said, "Brooksley, I have 13 bankers in my office, and they say if you regulate over-the-counter derivatives, you will cause the greatest crisis in the financial system since World War II." So, you know, Brooksley Bourne called this early. She called it right. She was forced out of the administration by the people who believed very strongly that more deregulation was good.
Yeah, and their argument for more deregulation was that it spurs innovation, and the argument against regulation is that it stifles innovation. And was there still a belief at that point, or that these derivatives actually did lessen risk rather than raise it?
Terrence, there is still such a belief. Okay, I live in. I'm serious. It's very important. I live in Washington. I work on this day to day. The baseline scenario is a record of our engagement on those issues. And I talk to people on Capitol Hill. I talk to people at the top level within the administration whenever they're willing to talk. And there are still many very influential people who believe that derivatives can be and generally are used to reduce risk rather than to build risk. And look, if you want proofs, look no further than the Dodd bill and the legislation that will probably come from the Agriculture Committee in the coming days, which will be specifically on derivatives. There is something in there called the end user exemption, which allows industrial companies, non-financial companies, to basically have whatever derivative positions they want. And this has been fought for by a lobby, partly of the non-financial sector, but honestly, the financial sector is very much behind this. And it's fundamentally dangerous. I mean, you will see many non-financial companies get into trouble as a result of derivative positions that they fundamentally do not understand.
Do not understand, yeah. Your title comes from the March 27th, 2009 meeting at the White House with the heads of 13 U.S. banks, during which Obama said, quote, "My administration is the only thing between you and the pitchforks." And after which, his spokesman Robert Gibbs said, "We're all in this together." Was that meeting a turning point, and what happened there?
Well, that meeting was intensely symbolic, and in some senses, a turning point, or a turning point not taken, because the financial system had to be saved. You can't run this economy without credit. That's I think pretty clear. I think that's pretty clear to anyone who works on these issues. But the idea that you had to save these banks as is, without firing management, without changing boards of directors, without imposing serious permanent limits on compensation, bonuses, key staff, power structures, empires, attitudes, that's quite extraordinary. And that's very much at odds with best practice. So, you know, again, I'm from the IMF. I've worked on crises for a long time. Actually, I worked with the IMF for about 4 years out of the last 7 years. Prior to that, I worked with other people. I worked with governments who were negotiating with the IMF. I worked with the private sector who were, you know, trying to invest in countries that are in trouble with an eye to helping them recover, or hoping to make money as they recover. I've worked as an academic on these issues. And I can absolutely assure you that best practice never involves unconditional bailouts for the structures that got you into trouble. I mean, it wouldn't make sense, right? I mean, if your kid crashes the car, you need to figure out, was it a complete accident or was it some reckless driving? And it's your kid, right? And you think, well, then maybe we should discuss this, you know, the conditions under which you're allowed to drive the car, you know, the level of your training, and what kind of car you can drive. I mean, this is just common sense.
Yeah.
And it's also standard best practice. And that's what the U.S. Treasury in the 1990s urged upon countries to which it was lending through the IMF. And, of course, the U.S. Treasury in the 1990s was run by Mr. Rubin, Mr. Summers.
Others, conditions were necessary. For us, us being Rubin and his cronies, no longer necessary, according to him.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the conditions. I mean, the word conditionality sets a lot of people off. The point is, you know, do you change? Do you use the moment of crisis to change? Do you let the moment of crisis go to waste? And the other person who was very involved in the 90s in pushing countries in, you know, broadly in this dimension, a sensible way, was, of course, Tim Geithner, who was a relatively junior member of the team, but absolutely critical member, according to all accounts.
And on international.
Yeah, and now he's Secretary of the Treasury, and his policies are completely at odds with what he himself recommended and pushed and worked towards for other countries in the 1990s.
Yeah. You quote him, Geithner, as describing this meltdown as a 40-year flood. That's quotes. almost a natural disaster. There's at least a couple things wrong with that description, aren't there?
Yes, I haven't tried to count the number of things wrong with it. The basic point, Terence, is, and this is also why we wrote the book, right? We want people to understand that what happened was not random. It was not out of the blue. There's a structure that has changed. And this is, you know, this is not an anti-market book. It's not an anti-American book. It's trying to place our current situation in this historical context. It's actually, I think, we end up pretty optimistic. Some readers say we're too optimistic.
Right. We'll talk about
that. Yeah, because I think in the end, we've been through this before, and we've dealt with it before as a democracy. And that's the context in which you want to place this. It is absolutely not a 40-year flood.
Yeah. And it's also, it's not accidental. And you say that whole 40-year number is off, that we have had bumps and crises every 4 to 7. And so,
well, if we push the metaphor, what I would say, Terence, is we have regular storms. We weaken the levees. Okay, so the levees are weaker after 40 years. We may have the same type storm, or we may think the storms could get bigger. Interesting question. But the point is, the levees were shown in September 2008 to have been decisively weakened.
Yeah,
I was thinking of. Shouldn't we strengthen the levees?
I was thinking of Katrina. It wasn't that the storm was the worst storm. It's that.
Well, that was a bad storm. It was a bad storm, and there was plenty of bad luck there. But the levees were the key.
But the levees were the key. Exactly. What is the state of things in D.C. right now? And I'd like you to talk about two things. We have two tracks in play. One is the Angelides Commission, which is looking into what happened and how to fix it. And the other is, I'll call it the Dodd financial reform legislation. First of all, what's happening with the investigation?
Well, there are other tracks also, Terence. There's investigations and hearings being held within the Senate by Senate 11, for example, within Homeland Security. And there are other hearings that I think are going to develop, particularly because this week we had huge news about Goldman Sachs being sued with a civil action for fraud by the SEC. Now, that's going to play into both the Angelides inquiry and, I think, into the Dodd bill
What does that mean? In other words, not what's the definition of it, but what's the implication of the SEC actually suing Goldman Sachs? I mean, many of us, I think, would have thought they'll never do that.
Well, Senator Ted Kaufman of Delaware, who is an appointed senator, is appointed to Joe Biden's seat, and he's not running for re-election, has been speaking with great clarity on this issue, and he gave a great speech a couple of weeks ago saying, you know, the fraud that's still at the heart of Wall Street, basically arguing that these big Wall Street firms, in addition to all the other problems and issues, have been mistreating and ripping off their customers. And I think when he gave that speech, a lot of people thought he was kind of pushing it a little bit. But what we're seeing from this, with this action of the SEC today, which is one specific case, one specific instance, is confirmation of a broad pattern of behavior. And also Senate 11's hearings this week
on
Washington Mutual, on WaMu, were, in a slightly different context, hitting exactly the same point. And, of course, we also had the Veloukis report on Lehman.
On Lehman, what, a month ago?
Right, which focused on the way in which Lehman essentially misled investors and also suggested strongly that there would be civil action, at least, against Lehman. And
now, you keep saying civil action. It is difficult to succeed in criminal action in these sorts of cases.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, and my knowledge of criminal action is limited, but as you know, there are different standards of evidence that you have to present. You need much more evidence for criminal cases. And remember, these cases are complex, right? And if you're going before a jury, which presumably is where you're going, you know, the record of pursuing serious fraud in the Anglo-American legal system is pretty mixed.
And the more complex the issues, the less likely that jury of your peers is going to be the place that that's really going to be handled.
I think you should presume that the defendants in these cases will have the very best legal representation. And yes, I think the complexity is something that can be used in this instance to their advantage. So, you know, I think the SEC is stacked. I know the SEC has got plenty of good lawyers who would like to make progress on this, and the Department of Justice is the same way.
Now, by the way, the SEC in the Bush administration under, I forget the first person, but then Cox, who was, you know, just, I mean, he seemed like the absolutely worst person from my point of view from his history. Has there been a change at the SEC, or has it just gotten so bad that they finally took action?
That's a good question. They've certainly taken action. Let's see how far this goes, and let's judge them based on the results.
Right.
I have completely, consistently held to the view that the people appointed by President Obama can do this job. They just need different policies and different leadership from the top. So I welcome what they did this week, and I look forward with eager anticipation to further cases.
Now, there was also a case recently, the Connecticut Attorney General has, I believe, filed suit against the ratings agencies, or I'm not sure what exactly the term is, but he's prosecuting the rating agencies for fraud or negligence. Are you aware of that one?
That one I'm not not up on.
For a second about sure. the rating agencies. I mean, obviously, in this kind of game, if you will, the one of the important referees is the rating agencies. They took credit default swaps and even later collateralized debt obligations, which contained, as we know, terrible trash, and kept rating them A. They were also paid for those ratings by the financial giants whose products they were rating. What's your sense of that? And was that negligent, or I mean negligent like on the level of criminality?
Well, I'm not in a position to take a view on the
legality.
Yeah, what you can get them for. Clearly, there's massive conflicts of interest in that system, and it's deeply broken. They were rating them AAA, by the way. They were saying these are as safe as U.S. Treasuries.
Yeah.
That's a fascinating question: why they believe that, and to what extent they truly believe that. But I strongly suspect that's going to be hard to go after them in court. I think we have to revise that system.
Yeah, they're defending themselves with the First Amendment. That all they gave was opinions, free speech. I mean, this is nutty because trillions of dollars were lost based on their recommendations. This is not just an opinion. Okay, let's move from the investigations to the legislative proposals that are now in motion. What is happening right now?
Well, there is a bill that has passed the House, as you know, end of last year, and there is now a bill coming to the floor of the Senate, probably in a week or so, the so-called Dodd bill coming from the Senate Banking Committee. And the issue before us is very much whether this bill will get stronger or weaker. And I think in that context, the case brought against Goldman Sachs will definitely push things towards the stronger side.
And how so? In other words, it obviously doesn't change anything really about what's needed, but you're saying that it will embolden those people who call for serious reform?
I think it's an enormous and unambiguous validation of the views of Ted Kaufman, Senators Levin, Merkley, and Brown from the
Democratic Sherrod Brown of Ohio.
Exactly. And Jeff Merkley of Oregon. They have been arguing and pushing hard and proposing amendments that would strengthen the legislation. And I think, honestly, I think if we got what they're arguing for, this would be a good round on the legislation. I personally think we'll have to come back for more later. But at least to our way of thinking, that the Dodd bill could become good, not great, but good and worth supporting, or it could become mush.
Yeah,
and that would be much less.
And so this SEC filing seems to give you some hope that it may become better rather than worse.
I think the banner headlines over the weekends around the world are going to be, you know, Goldman Sachs accused of fraud. Goldman Sachs is accused of mistreating its customers. Goldman Sachs stock price has fallen sharply. At least that, as we speak now, that's the case. Goldman Sachs, the most arguably the best connected bank in the United States, not at all the low-hanging fruit from the point of view of pursuing them, is in serious trouble. And I think that is a simple point. It's a very clear point. You can write it in a headline. You can explain it in 300 words. And I think it...
Unlike a derivative, this is not complex.
Exactly. Well, it is. I mean, obviously...
The message.
Correct. This is like Enron and its oil barges, Nigerian oil barges.
Right.
It was a complex deal. Enron was doing a lot of stuff that's hard to explain. But they engaged in a fraudulent transaction. Merrill Lynch helped them. People went to jail.
And Arthur Andersen completely disappeared.
Arthur Andersen, as an accounting firm, went out of business.
Yeah. Just to be a little bit more specific, what are the strengths and weaknesses of the current proposals? How could they get better? How could they get mushy? If you can give us just a little bit of that as it stands today.
So there are three pieces to the legislation. There's a consumer protection piece, which really, to be effective, requires establishment of a strong, sufficiently independent agency. And Elizabeth Warren has been pushing this for a long time. And there, I would suggest people who are interested watch carefully what Elizabeth says. And if Elizabeth buys into and says this is enough and we can make it work, then I would support her. The second part is around derivatives. And that I would absolutely concede and agree is the most complicated part. I actually think we'll make a little bit of progress, but not too much.
Now, would progress be that, at the most simple level, that so much of that was designed and to my mind, and built up because it was unregulated, that was a place they could play outside of government eyes? Are we talking about just making them through exchanges that are transparent?
Yes. That would, the extent of progress there should be measured as how much of those transactions come onto regulated exchanges, and how, the extent to which people have to hold a lot more capital against that, so it becomes less speculative. But unfortunately, there is, as I mentioned, this so-called end-user lobby that is very powerful, that has already got a lot of exemptions into that. Because of the power of that lobby,
who is the end user lobby?
Well, the end user lobby is actually JP Morgan Chase and its friends.
So it's the
working with companies.
They're end users.
Yes, yes. So I mean, this is a pretty unholy alliance, and I am very sympathetic on this point to Senator Dodd's people, for example, who've had to fight against them. And this is one reason we'll have to come back around for more progress on derivatives. And I think that the key issue, the real central part of the debate, which could go either way right now, is on the so-called too big to fail.
The third
side.
One.
Yeah, the third piece of it. See, our view, and the view of these Democratic senators, who I think are exactly on the right page, is that you should combine everything in the Dodd bill, take all of that, plus put a hard cap on the size and arguably also the leverage, the amount of borrowing that you can have in our biggest banks. And there the striking factor, and again, a very important reason that we wrote this book, is to show people, and we go through all the evidence and we talk about all the literature from both from the academic side and from the practitioner side and from the policy side. There is no evidence of economies of scale or scope or other benefits to society from having banks bigger than $100 billion in total assets.
And so people get a sense of perspective. How big are the big banks that are too big to fail?
When Citigroup essentially failed in fall 2008, it was a $2.5 trillion bank. JP Morgan Chase today is a $2 trillion bank, and Jamie Dimon has said to his shareholders recently he'd like to get bigger because he thinks that's the outcome of a market process. But when you're at that scale, it's not about markets, it's about the government standing behind you. And I just came to you from a meeting where I talked to people who work very deeply on the bond market, and they look very carefully at the credit risk of banks, and they confirmed exactly what we say in the book and what I've been saying around the country, which is there is a implicit subsidy from the guarantee that creditors feel you have if you're JP Morgan Chase or Citigroup or Bank of America. So that's an unfair distortion of the market.
Yeah, so people get what we're talking about here. One problem is if they're too big to fail, you will bail them out. And so that means they can take enormous risk and we're going to be left with it. But what you're saying is in the day-to-day operations, because they are viewed as too big to fail, because they have a safety net that others do not, they get an advantage every single day when they're looking for capital?
Yeah, absolutely. Their funding, all the funding that they use to run their business, the so-called wholesale funding that they get from the market, which is very, very big for these firms, is based on the market's view of the viability of these firms. And if they feel that you're so big the government will stand behind you under pressure, that's an advantage. It's an unfair advantage. It's the too big to fail advantage. And it's a form of taxpayer subsidy. You should be very clear on this. That's non-transparent, hence, you know, we're taking quite a lot of words to explain it. And it's very dangerous because it encourages firms to become even bigger.
Oh, that's right. Of course. If when I'm competing with you and you're a $100 billion bank and I'm a $1 trillion bank, I get an advantage. And I've heard you say 0.7 to 0.8 of a percentage point. But when we're talking billions of dollars over the course of a year, that's a lot of money.
Oh, that's a huge amount of money.
And that I get that advantage every single day over you.
Yeah, exactly right.
And it's and so, of course, if I'm not quite that big, I want to get that big. And
yes.
If I am that big, I want to get bigger, because the bigger I am, the more I get that daily advantage.
Yeah, and the bigger you are, the bigger your bonus. Right?
Yes, of course.
So there's more upside for the people running it. But the downside, Wall Street gets the upside, taxpayer gets the downside. It's a very old expression. And what it means very concretely in these circumstances is if you mess up and you fail and you run a $10 billion hedge fund, that's your problem and your investors are going to be unhappy, and you know, we can discuss to what extent, you know, society cares about that. Not very much would be my answer. If you run a $2 trillion bank and you get into trouble, then you're going to get some form of support or rescue or the cost, even if we manage not to save you and your job.
Right.
We're still going to be on the hook for a huge amount of taxpayer money.
Right, right. How would you break up the big banks?
Well,
how would you handle the too big to fail question?
The specific proposal that we've made, and that's actually reflected in these Senate amendments that we're expecting, we'll see what happens when the legislation comes to the floor, but our specific proposal is put a hard size cap on the size of the largest banks. And we propose 4% of GDP if you want to call yourself a boring utility-type bank, you just run the payment system, and 2% of GDP if you want to be a risky, exciting Goldman Sachs type of bank, assuming Goldman Sachs does continue forward. Now, in dollar terms, there would be a further adjustment below that size cap based on how risky you really are. So there's a piece that the regulators have to decide. I would estimate that a Goldman Sachs would come out of this no bigger than $100 billion would be the headline number. That's about one-tenth to one-eighth of its current size.
You're saying if this legislation had the wallop you want.
Absolutely. So Senator Brown's amendment, for example, is a hard cap of 3% of GDP, for example, and I think that's pointing very much in the same direction.
And as you point out, by the way, there is legislation, the 94 Regal-Neal Act, that limits bank size.
Yeah.
It's just hasn't kept up with the evolution. And I want you to mention two things here when you address that. One is in size. And two is the fact that what people thought banks did is no longer where the action is.
Right. So the Regal-Neal Act had a very sensible provision in this regard. It said no bank can have more than 10% of total retail deposits in the country. Okay? So nobody could get too big economically and too big politically. But that was 1994. Since then, the big expansion of banking has not been about retail deposits. It's about so-called wholesale lending, where the banks lend to each other and find ways to increase that dimension of the credit system. And it also turns out the Regal-Neal Act had some loopholes that, you know, compliant regulators would let you drive big things through, like Bank of America. Now, we just say, let's modernize and update the Regal-Neal Act, right?
This not is something, radical.
This is something we do. In America, we do this all the time. It's a very practical nation. As the world changes, which it does every day, we recognize the need to modernize our legislation.
Right. If car design changes, you change your safety requirements.
Absolutely.
If financial design changes, you change your safety requirements.
If somebody invents an airbag, the car analogy is good. If somebody invents airbags, you then have to think about the rules around, you know, do you want the airbag to inflate if a small person, very light person is sitting in the front passenger seat, right?
Right.
Because that was not an issue before the airbag existed. So the massive expansion of wholesale financing around banks doesn't mean that we should ban wholesale financing or close down our entire banking system. It means we should update and modernize the rules around this. And this specifically means, in our context, in addition to everything else on the table, we should put a hard size cap on the size of our largest banks.
And the likelihood of that happening, do you have any sense?
Well, prior to the SEC suing Goldman Sachs for fraud, I was saying it was a small chance, perhaps 5%. But this is a game changer. This is a I would call this.
So I'm actually interviewing. This is Friday morning. The news has just broken. You're as curious to see how this plays out as anyone else.
Well, if I wasn't talking to you, Terrence, I would be continuing to work the phones across the country and even fielding calls from outside the country. People arguing and discussing with me what's going on and what this means and so on. I think, Terrence, I mean, I'm still in my first reaction to this.
Right.
But I'm calling this a Pecora moment. Ferdinand Pecora, you remember, was the guy in the 1930s who brought effective prosecutorial type investigation. It was actually through the Senate committee.
Right. In other words, what the Angelides Commission is today was the Pecora Commission there, only the Pecora Commission, we don't know how the Angelides Commission is going to turn out, but the Pecora Commission had some teeth and took some bite.
Well, Pecora wasn't actually a commission. Pecora was a committee of the Senate, and he was the chief counsel, and he had a much more investigative, hard-nosed attack approach than the Angelides Commission has been able to put together so far. But the analogy is a good one, and the point is that Pecora nailed the big financial guys for fraud. Actually, tax fraud in many cases, and it also made them look really bad. And that's important because you got to get this through. It has to break through people's consciousness. It has to be in a form that you can – the headline tells you everything, and the 300-word editorial absolutely nails it. And we have it now.
And what you're saying there is that for the mood in the country, in other words, we know that the senators, legislators who are making these decisions – get an awful lot of money from the financial sector. So there has to be a countervailing force of public opinion that gives them the strength to take action that their funders don't want.
Absolutely. In fact, taking money from Goldman Sachs now should be regarded as a toxic asset.
Ah.
If you took money from Goldman Sachs, and if you're listening to the show, I strongly advise you to return it on Monday morning.
And Goldman Sachs was, I believe, the largest contributor to the Obama campaign in 2008.
I haven't had a chance to go check that, but now you say it, Terrence, I will go look at that.
Yeah. And I'm not absolutely certain, but I believe I read that in the last few days. Okay. Your title includes the words, "The Next Financial Meltdown. Is another inevitable, and if so, why? When?"
Well, the when is always the hardest question. The why is obvious. I mean, if the structure changed in a way to become dangerous, caused a mega crisis, and we didn't fix it, how would you expect any other outcome? I mean, this is not a go down and stay down type situation. It's a go down, take a massive hit, lose 8 million jobs, run up a huge amount of government debt trying to prevent a second Great Depression, narrowly escape that, but you don't change the structure of the financial system. You give them the same incentives. They're too big to fail. I think, Terrence, a very good definition of insanity that is in the popular culture is that insanity is repeating the same thing over and over again and expecting different outcomes.
Okay, so in other words, your whole thing, the book says The Next Financial Meltdown, the if there is, or the unless is, unless we really take strong action in terms of reducing these too big to fails in size. And we didn't talk about leverage. What looks like it's happening and what needs to happen in terms of leverage? And leverage is how much risk they can take in terms of the dollar you have to back up what you're playing with. Is that pretty much true?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, the leverage thing is hard to know where that's going. I think the size cap, it's clearer. More people can understand it. More people can rally around it. There are unfortunately limits to what you can legislate. Some things have to be left to the real detail guys. And the size cap is something that you can put in a statute that will be very hard. You can make it hard to overturn that. You can make it hard for the regulators to not force compliance with it. Leverage will depend on regulators. And honestly, another reason I wrote the book is to try and change the consensus and address the ideology, because the regulators have to change their minds. It is striking that some of the leading thinkers in the United Kingdom, Mervyn King, head of the Bank of England, Andrew Haldane, Director of Financial Stability at the Bank of England, Adair Turner, head of the financial supervisors in the UK, they all get this, Terence. They could all come on your show, if they were willing, next time they're out here, and have exactly the same sort of conversation.
They would sit there and have your point of view.
Well, they might be a little less blunt on their language than me, but yes, they get this. Now, in the US, who do we have on the official side who gets this? Thomas Hoenig, president of the Kansas City Fed. Richard Fisher, president of the Dallas Fed. Now, these are good guys. This is what you need. And maybe there are one or two other people in the Federal Reserve system, but that's it. I haven't heard anybody, for example, from the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve say anything sensible at all on this issue.
Yeah. It looks to me, one of the things you point out when you hearken back to the 1900s and so on is oligarchy. And back then it was, you know, it was the big trusts, it was the railroads and so on. And now one of the things that I first learned from Kevin Phillips in when we discussed bad money is the enormous growth of the financial sector from 7% of the economy to 20% over basically the period we're talking about, right, from the mid-70s to the present.
Well, it depends how you define it and measure it. I mean, I would use a somewhat narrower definition perhaps than Kevin does. And there we have a movement from, in terms of percent of GDP, from 3-4% to 8%. But the key, that's not the big number to focus on. The big number to focus on is the compensation and the share of corporate profits, where the finance peaked at an unbelievable 40% of total corporate profits in the early 2000s.
Total corporate profits go to finance.
40% went to finance.
Oh, my God,
40%. And we look. I mean, look, we may see something similar this year.
Right.
Depending on
now,
how the economy
it looks
out.
To me, and maybe I'm off in my definition, but it looks to me like we have a number of sort of oligarchic industries, not just finance, but in energy, in healthcare, in agriculture, that end up driving this supposedly, this allegedly representative government in ways that no longer are representative.
Well, I think that's fair, and I think that's also goes back to Jefferson, right? Now, Jefferson had his own idea about what should be the economic basis of the country and the social basis, and I'm not sure you would buy into his view of either small farmers or slavery.
Right, either.
But
small farmers with slaves, yes.
Right, but the rise of corporate America and the political rights of corporations are, without question, a big issue for us to address going forward. Nothing scares me like finance scares me,
okay,
Terrence, because nothing can do as much damage as finance.
Right,
And that's very important. I do think that this is a winnable battle, that we can take this on, and if we as the public, as the voters, prevail in a productive manner, we can go on to address these other issues too.
Let me say, if I gave you 1 minute to explain your optimism, what is it?
I'm an immigrant. I became an American. I opted into this system. I chose to become a citizen. And I studied long and hard for the citizenship test, actually. I took that seriously. What I learned from that, and what I learned from working on this economy and writing this book, is that we've been through this before. You know, the American democracy was not given easily or lightly. It was taken, and it was taken with great insistence and perseverance. And it has been confronted from the outside and also from the inside repeatedly. And from the inside, it's the concentrated financial and industrial interests that have risen up that are actually a product of our innovativeness and our entrepreneurship in this country. New people can set up new things. They're unregulated at the beginning. You make a ton of money. You plow that into politics. You buy yourself favor. And it's a cycle we go through, Terrence. And every time we've faced this so far, 200 years of the Republic, we, the Democrats, have won. And we just have to do it again.
Is that small D Democrats?
I can do small D or big D, depending on who wants to come with me. The blurbs in the book, by the way, on the back cover, and we put a lot of them in the front to show this, are from the right, the left, and the center. Okay? A lot of people get this. What I just said to you was a free market philosophy, right?
Exactly.
Recognizing that the people who go free can go unregulated and make a ton of money and destroy the free market basis of our economy.
Roosevelt saved capitalism.
Both Roosevelts. Theodore Roosevelt definitely saved it from the right. I mean, he was a centrist guy, but a right of center guy. He was on the side of small business, small entrepreneurs, farmers, artisans, workers, against the big trusts. That's the thinking we have to take now, update, modernize, apply it to the big banks.
Very good. And I will just say that the one thing I didn't get to, and I'm not going to get to, is, for me, public financing campaigns is essential for us to ever wrest things from the power of finance or any of those other large industries. So again, the book is 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover, The Next Financial Meltdown. The website is baselinescenario.com. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others at any time during the week by linking to the podcast. You can also sign up to have delivered to you weekly either at iTunes or at my website, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, terrencemcnally.net. For podcast articles and transcripts, go to that website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement, you can sign up there or email me at T.E. McNally at Mac.com. Thank you, Simon Johnson. Keep up the good work.
You too.